by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, Lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs, and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, Behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east, and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only.
Epilogue. Myth and Society. 1. The Shapeshifter. There is no final system for the interpretation of myths, and there will never be any such thing. Mythology is like the god Proteus, the ancient one of the sea, whose speech is sooth. The god will make assay and take all manner of shapes of things that creep upon the earth, of water likewise, and of fierce fire burning. The life voyager wishing to be taught by Proteus must grasp him steadfastly and press him yet the more, and at length he will appear in his proper shape. But this wily god never discloses even to the skillful questioner the whole content of his wisdom. He will reply only to the question put to him, and what he discloses will be great or trivial, according to the question asked.
So often as the sun in his course stands high in mid-heaven, then forth from the brine comes the ancient one of the sea, whose speech is sooth. Before the breath of the west wind he comes, and the sea's dark ripple covers him. And when he is got forth, he lies down to sleep in the hollow of the caves, and around him the seals, the brood of the fair daughter of the brine, sleep all in a flock, stolen forth from the grey sea water, and bitter is the scent they breathe of the deeps of the salt sea.
The Greek warrior king Menelaus, who was guided by a helpful daughter of this old sea father to the wild lair, and instructed by her how to wring from the god his response, desired only to ask the secret of his own personal difficulties, and the whereabouts of his personal friends. And the god did not disdain to reply. Mythology has been interpreted by the modern intellect as a primitive, fumbling effort to explain the world of nature, Fraser. As a production of poetical fantasy from prehistoric times, misunderstood by succeeding ages, Muller. as a repository of allegorical instruction to shape the individual to his group, Durkheim, as a group dream, symptomatic of archetypal urges within the depths of the human psyche, Jung, as the traditional vehicle of man's profoundest metaphysical insights, Kumaraswami, and as God's revelation to his children, the Church. Mythology is all of these. The various judgments are determined by the viewpoints of the judges. For when scrutinized in terms not of what it is, but of how it functions, of how it has served mankind in the past, of how it may serve today, mythology shows itself to be as amenable as life itself to the obsessions and requirements of the individual, the race, the age. 2. The function of myth, cult, and meditation. In his life form, the individual is necessarily only a fraction and distortion of the total image of man. He is limited either as male or as female. At any given period of his life, he is again limited as child, youth, mature adult, or ancient. Furthermore, in his life role, he is necessarily specialized as craftsman, tradesman, servant, or thief, priest, leader, wife, nun, or harlot. He cannot be all. Hence the totality, the fullness of man, is not in the separate member, but in the body of the society as a whole. The individual can be only an organ. From his group he has derived his techniques of life, the language in which he thinks, the ideas on which he thrives. Through the past of that society descended the genes that built his body. If he presumes to cut himself off, either in deed or in thought and feeling, he only breaks connection with the sources of his existence. The tribal ceremonies of birth, initiation, marriage, burial, installation, and so forth serve to translate the individual's life crises and life deeds into classic impersonal forms. They disclose him to himself, not as this personality or that, but as the warrior, the bride, the widow, the priest, the chieftain, at the same time rehearsing for the rest of the community the old lesson of the archetypal stages. All participate in the ceremonial according to rank and function. The whole society becomes visible to itself as an imperishable living unit. Generations of individuals pass like anonymous cells from a living body, but the sustaining, timeless form remains. By an enlargement of vision to embrace this super-individual, each discovers himself enhanced, enriched, supported, and magnified. His role, however unimpressive, is seen to be intrinsic to the beautiful festival image of man, the image, potential yet necessarily inhibited within himself. Social duties continue the lesson of the festival into normal everyday existence, and the individual is validated still. Conversely, indifference, revolt, or exile break the vitalizing connectives. From the standpoint of the social unit, the broken-off individual is simply nothing, waste. Whereas the man or woman who can honestly say that he or she has lived the role, whether that of priest, harlot, queen, or slave, is something in the full sense of the verb to be. Rites of initiation and installation, then, teach the lesson of the essential oneness of the individual and the group. Seasonal festivals open a larger horizon. As the individual is an organ of society, so is the tribe or city, so is humanity entire, only a phase of the mighty organism of the cosmos. It has been customary to describe the seasonal festivals of so-called native peoples as efforts to control nature. This is a misrepresentation. There is much of the will to control in every act of man, and particularly in those magical ceremonies that are thought to bring rain clouds, cure sickness, or stay the flood. Nevertheless, the dominant motive in all truly religious, as opposed to black magical ceremonial, is that of submission to the inevitables of destiny. And in the seasonal festivals, this motive is particularly apparent. No tribal rite has yet been recorded which attempts to keep winter from descending. On the contrary, the rites all prepare the community to endure, together with the rest of nature, the season of the terrible cold. And in the spring, the rites do not seek to compel nature to pour forth immediately corn, beans, and squash for the lean community. On the contrary, the rites dedicate the whole people to the work of nature's season. The wonderful cycle of the year, with its hardships and periods of joy, is celebrated and delineated and represented as continued in the life round of the human group. Many other symbolizations of this continuity fill the world of the mythologically instructed community. For example, the clans of the American hunting tribes commonly regarded themselves as descended from half-animal, half-human ancestors. These ancestors fathered not only the human members of the clan, but also the animal species after which the clan was named. Thus, the human members of the beaver clan were blood cousins of the animal beavers, protectors of the species and in turn protected by the animal wisdom of the wood folk. Or another example, the hogan or mud hut of the Navajos of New Mexico and Arizona is constructed on the plan of the Navajo image of the cosmos. The entrance faces east. The eight sides represent the four directions and the points between. Every beam and joist corresponds to an element in the great hogan of the all-embracing earth and sky. And since the soul of man itself is regarded as identical in form with the universe, the mud hut is a representation of the basic harmony of man and world, and a reminder of the hidden life way of perfection. But there is another way, in diametric opposition to that of social duty and the popular cult. From the standpoint of the way of duty, anyone in exile from the community is a nothing. From the other point of view, however, this exile is the first step of the quest. Each carries within himself the all. Therefore, it may be sought and discovered within. The differentiations of sex, age, and occupation are not essential to our character, but mere costumes which we wear for a time on the stage of the world. The image of man within is not to be confounded with the garments. We think of ourselves as Americans, children of the 20th century, Occidentals, civilized Christians. We are virtuous or sinful. Yet such designations do not tell what it is to be man. They denote only the accidents of geography, birth date, and income. What is the core of us? What is the basic character of our being? The asceticism of the medieval saints and of the yogis of India, the Hellenistic mystery initiations, the ancient philosophies of the East and of the West are techniques for the shifting of the emphasis of individual consciousness away from the garments. The preliminary meditations of the aspirant detach his mind and sentiments from the accidents of life and drive him to the core. I am not that, he meditates, not my mother or son who has just died, my body which is ill or aging, my arm, my eye, my head, not the summation of all these things. I am not my feeling, not my mind, not my power of intuition. By such meditations he is driven to his own profundity and breaks through at last to unfathomable realizations. No man can return from such exercises and take very seriously himself as Mr. So-and-so of such-and-such a township, USA. society and duties drop away. Mr. So-and-so, having discovered himself big with man, becomes indrawn and aloof. This is the stage of Narcissus looking into the pool, of the Buddha sitting contemplative under the tree, but it is not the ultimate goal. It is a requisite step, but not the end. The aim is not to see, but to realize that one is that essence. Then one is free to wander as that essence in the world. Furthermore, the world too is of that essence, the essence of oneself and the essence of the world. These two are one. Hence separateness, withdrawal, is no longer necessary. Wherever the hero may wander, whatever he may do, he is ever in the presence of his own essence, for he has the perfected eye to see. There is no separateness. Thus, just as the way of social participation may lead in the end to a realization of the all in the individual, so that of exile brings the hero to the self in all. Centered in this hub point, the question of selfishness or altruism disappears. The individual has lost himself in the law and been reborn in identity with the whole meaning of the universe. For him, by him, the world was made. O Muhammad, God said, hadst thou not been, I would not have created the sky. 3. The hero today. All of which is far indeed from the contemporary view. For the democratic ideal of the self-determining individual, the invention of the power-driven machine, and the development of the scientific method of research have so transformed human life that the long-inherited, timeless universe of symbols has collapsed. In the fateful, epoch-announcing words of Nietzsche's Zarathustra, "Dead are all the gods." One knows the tale. It has been told a thousand ways. It is the hero cycle of the modern age, the wonder story of mankind's coming to maturity. The spell of the past, the bondage of tradition, was shattered with sure and mighty strokes. The dream web of myth fell away. The mind opened to full waking consciousness, and modern man emerged from ancient ignorance like a butterfly from its cocoon, or like the sun at dawn from the womb of Mother Night. It is not only that there is no hiding place for the gods from the searching telescope and microscope. There is no such society anymore as the gods once supported. The social unit is not a carrier of religious content, but an economic-political organization. Its ideals are not those of the hieratic pantomime, making visible on earth the forms of heaven, but of the secular state, in hard and unremitting competition for material supremacy and resources. Isolated societies, dream-bounded within a mythologically charged horizon, no longer exist except as areas to be exploited. And within the progressive societies themselves, every last vestige of the ancient human heritage of ritual, morality, and art is in full decay. The problem of mankind today, therefore, is precisely the opposite to that of men in the comparatively stable periods of those great coordinating mythologies which now are known as lies. Then all meaning was in the group, in the great anonymous forms, none in the self-expressive individual. Today, no meaning is in the group, none in the world, all is in the individual. But there the meaning is absolutely unconscious. One does not know toward what one moves. One does not know by what one is propelled. The lines of communication between the conscious and the unconscious zones of the human psyche have all been cut, and we have been split. in two. The hero deed to be wrought is not today what it was in the century of Galileo. Where then there was darkness, now there is light. But also where light was, there now is darkness. The modern hero deed must be that of questing to bring to light again the lost Atlantis of the coordinated soul. Obviously, this work cannot be wrought by turning back or away from what has been accomplished by the modern revolution. For the problem is nothing if not that of rendering the modern world spiritually significant, or rather, phrasing the same principle the other way round, nothing if not that of making it possible for men and women to come to full human maturity through the conditions of contemporary life. Indeed, these conditions themselves are what have rendered the ancient formulae ineffective, misleading, and even pernicious. The community today is the planet, not the bounded nation. Hence the patterns of projected aggression which formerly served to coordinate the in-group now can only break it into factions. The national idea, with the flag as totem, is today an aggrandizer of the nursery ego, not the annihilator of an infantile situation. Its parody rituals of the parade ground serve the ends of Holdfast, the tyrant dragon, not the god in whom self-interest is annihilate. And the numerous saints of this anti-cult, namely the patriots whose ubiquitous photographs, draped with flags, serve as official icons, are precisely the local threshold guardians, our demon sticky hair, whom it is the first problem of the hero to surpass. Nor can the great world religions, as at present understood, meet the requirement. For they have become associated with the causes of the factions as instruments of propaganda and self-congratulation. Even Buddhism has lately suffered this degradation in reaction to the lessons of the West. The universal triumph of the secular state has thrown all religious organizations into such a definitely secondary and finally ineffectual position that religious pantomime is hardly more today than a sanctimonious exercise for Sunday morning, whereas business ethics and patriotism stand for the remainder of the week. Such a monkey holiness is not what the functioning world requires. Rather, a transmutation of the whole social order is necessary, so that through every detail and act of secular life, the vitalizing image of the universal God-man, who is actually immanent and effective in all of us, may be somehow made known to consciousness. And this is not a work that consciousness itself can achieve. Consciousness can no more invent or even predict an effective symbol than foretell or control tonight's dream. The whole thing is being worked out on another level, through what is bound to be a long and very frightening process, not only in the depths of every living psyche in the modern world, but also on those titanic battlefields into which the whole planet has lately been converted. We are watching the terrible clash of the symplegades, through which the soul must pass, identified with neither side. But there is one thing we may know, namely that as the new symbols become visible, they will not be identical in the various parts of the globe. The circumstances of local life, race, and tradition must all be compounded in the effective forms. Therefore, it is necessary for men to understand and be able to see that through various symbols the same redemption is revealed. Truth is one, we read in the Vedas. The sages call it by many names. A single song is being inflected through all the colorations of the human choir. General propaganda for one or another of the local solutions, therefore, is superfluous. Or much rather, a menace. The way to become human is to learn to recognize the lineaments of God in all of the wonderful modulations of the face of man. With this, we come to the final hint of what the specific orientation of the modern hero task must be, and discover the real cause for the disintegration of all of our inherited religious formulae. The center of gravity, that is to say, of the realm of mystery and danger, has definitely shifted. For the primitive hunting peoples of those remotest human millennia, when the saber-toothed tiger, the mammoth, and the lesser presences of the animal kingdom were the primary manifestations of what was alien, the source at once of danger and of sustenance, the great human problem was to become linked psychologically to the task of sharing the wilderness with these beings. An unconscious identification took place, and this was finally rendered conscious in the half-human, half-animal figures of the mythological totem ancestors. The animals became the tutors of humanity. Through acts of literal imitation, such as today appear only on the children's playground, or in the madhouse, an effective annihilation of the human ego was accomplished, and society achieved a cohesive organization. Similarly, the tribes supporting themselves on plant food became cathected to the plant. The life rituals of planting and reaping were identified with those of human procreation, birth, and progress to maturity. Both the plant and the animal worlds, however, were in the end brought under social control, whereupon the great field of instructive wonder shifted to the skies, and mankind enacted the great pantomime of the sacred moon king, the sacred sun king, the hieratic planetary state, and the symbolic festivals of the world-regulating spheres. Today, all of these mysteries have lost their force. Their symbols no longer interest our psyche. The notion of a cosmic law, which all existence serves and to which man himself must bend, has long since passed through the preliminary mystical stages represented in the old astrology, and is now simply accepted in mechanical terms as a matter of course. The descent of the occidental sciences from the heavens to the earth, from 17th century astronomy to 19th century biology, and their concentration today, at last, on man himself, in 20th century anthropology and psychology, mark the path of a prodigious transfer of the focal point of human wonder. Not the animal world, not the plant world, not the miracle of the spheres, but man himself is now the crucial mystery. Man is that alien presence with whom the forces of egoism must come to terms, through whom the ego is to be crucified and resurrected, and in whose image society is to be reformed. Man, understood, however, not as I, but as thou, for the ideals and temporal institutions of no tribe, race, continent, social class, or century can be the measure of the inexhaustible and multifariously wonderful divine existence that is the life in all of us. The modern hero, the modern individual who dares to heed the call and seek the mansion of that presence with whom it is our whole destiny to be atoned, cannot, indeed must not, wait for his community to cast off its slough of pride, fear, rationalized avarice, and sanctified misunderstanding. Live, Nietzsche says, as though the day were here. It is not society that is to guide and save the creative hero, but precisely the reverse. And so every one of us shares the supreme ordeal, carries the cross of the Redeemer, not in the bright moments of his tribe's great victories, but in the silences of his personal despair. About the author. Joseph Campbell was an American author and teacher, best known for his work in the field of comparative mythology. He was born in New York City in 1904, and from early childhood he became interested in mythology. He loved to read books about American Indian cultures, and frequently visited the American Museum of Natural History in New York, where he was fascinated by the museum's collection of totem poles. Campbell was educated at Columbia University, where he specialized in medieval literature, and, after earning a master's degree, continued his studies at universities in Paris and Munich. While abroad, he was influenced by the art of Pablo Picasso and Henri Matisse, the novels of James Joyce and Thomas Mann, and the psychological studies of Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. These encounters led to Campbell's theory that all myths and epics are linked in the human psyche, and that they are cultural manifestations of the universal need to explain social, cosmological, and spiritual realities. After a period in California, where he encountered John Steinbeck and the biologist Ed Ricketts, he taught at the Canterbury School, and then, in 1934, joined the literature department at Sarah Lawrence College, a post he retained for many years. During the 1940s and 50s, he helped Swami Nikhilananda to translate the Upanishads and the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. He also edited works by the German scholar Heinrich Zimmer on Indian art, myths, and philosophy. In 1944, with Henry Morton Robinson, Campbell published A Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake. His first original work, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, came out in 1949 and was immediately well received. In time, it became acclaimed as a classic. In this study of The Myth of the Hero, Campbell asserted that there is a single pattern of heroic journey, and that all cultures share this essential pattern in their various heroic myths. In his book, he also outlined the basic conditions, stages, and results of the archetypal hero's journey. Joseph Campbell died in 1987. In 1988, a series of television interviews with Bill Moyers, The Power of Myth, introduced Campbell's views to millions of people. About the Joseph Campbell Foundation. The Joseph Campbell Foundation, JCF, is a non-profit corporation that continues the work of Joseph Campbell, exploring the fields of mythology and comparative religion. The foundation is guided by three principal goals. First, the foundation preserves, protects, and perpetuates Campbell's pioneering work. This includes cataloging and archiving his works, developing new publications based on his works, directing the sale and distribution of his published works, protecting copyrights to his works, and increasing awareness of his works by making them available in digital formats on JCF's website. Second, the foundation promotes the study of mythology and comparative religion. This involves implementing and/or supporting diverse mythological education programs, supporting and/or sponsoring events designed to increase public awareness, donating Campbell's archived works, principally to the Joseph Campbell and Maria Gimbutas Archive and Library, and utilizing JCF's website as a forum for relevant cross-cultural dialogue. Third, the foundation helps individuals enrich their lives by participating in a series of programs, including our global, Internet-based Associates Program, our local international network of mythological roundtables, and our periodic Joseph Campbell-related events and activities. About the collected works of Joseph Campbell. At his death in 1987, Joseph Campbell left a significant body of published work that explored his lifelong passion, the complex of universal myths and symbols that he called mankind's one great story. He also left, however, a large volume of unreleased work, uncollected articles, notes, letters, and diaries, as well as audio and videotape recorded lectures. The Joseph Campbell Foundation, founded in 1990 to preserve, protect, and perpetuate Campbell's work, has undertaken to create a digital archive of his papers and recordings, and to publish the collected works of Joseph Campbell. The Collected Works of Joseph Campbell. Robert Walter, Executive Editor. David Cudler, Managing Editor. For more information on Joseph Campbell and the Joseph Campbell Foundation, contact Joseph Campbell Foundation, www.jcf.org, Post Office Box 36, San Anselmo, California, 94979-0036. Email info@jcf.org. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, performed by Arthur Morey, John Lee, and Susan Deniker. Directed by Tony Hudds. Performance copyright 2015 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number: 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliantsaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.